Our last speaker of the conference, sad this conference is over, it's going to be over, is Blake Harish. Blake has a really interesting background. He has a degree in physics.
Chemistry.
But he went on and got his MDiv at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley and worked as an intern at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences and at a biotech company. And now he's doing his PhD with Phil Clayton at Claremont. It's a joint PhD in education and science and religion.
Yep.
And he's going to tell us about one strategy for doing science and religion courses. And as someone who works in education, this is sort of avant-garde educational research as well. So it's an exciting presentation for us. And now I'll turn it over to Phil.
Thank you. The organizers may not have realized that they've given a Baptist minister a mic at the end of something, and I don't know if that was a smart move. But I will try to keep it. Lunch ends at what, like 1 or 2? I can try to bring it in there. There may be a couple offerings involved as well. So today I want to talk about something called problem-based learning and why I think it might be something useful to use in science and religion courses. Now, I use the term science and religion actually very thoughtfully, because I realize that that ends up being kind of the broader term used that things like science and faith or science and theology can fall under. And knowing that some of you may not work in institutions where you could actually teach a science and theology course, but you could teach a science and religion course. So I did that on purpose so as to kind of make it as broad as you need it to be, and saying that it'll work in a number of these settings. So just a very quick reason why I even got interested in this at all. In November, there's a meeting of what's called the American Academy of Religion, which is the meeting for all various religion professionals, and I'm a religion grad student, so I went. And AAAS had a workshop that they hosted with the Association of Theological Schools, which is the accrediting body for a lot of seminaries and things like that. It was about how do you get science into seminary education. It was a great workshop. And at the end, they said, okay, what can we do? What are some steps to take? And they cited a lot of great things that they could try to move forward. But one of the themes that I saw is the resources they said they could give seminaries were all passive, in the sense that it's, okay, let's get some videos online that they can watch. Or let's get someone who come in that can talk to them. Or here's an article that they can read. And for me, the thing I've loved about science is how interactive it is. That there's the lecture, but then there's the lab. The part where you get to get your hands dirty, that you can make mistakes and try to figure out what's going on. And that's what, when I was doing science, that's what I loved. I did okay in lectures, but I shined in labs. And so I was thinking, how could I do this with a science and religion course? How could I make it more like a lab? And I stumbled across this thing called problem-based learning. And so here's our little chalkboard for today. So let me just tell you a couple basic characteristics of problem-based learning. First off, it's student-driven, in the sense that the goal is to try to make the students understand a particular topic where they are. And so problems are designed for a particular group of people. You can't write a problem and say it's going to work in every setting. You have to write it for your audience and say, what is actually going to make these students get engaged with this topic? So that's a big thing. It's not just, I teach chemistry, and chemistry is the same for everyone. It's this particular topic in science and religion. Another key characteristic is that problem-based learning is almost always cooperative. So students are always working in groups with one another to work through the problems that are presented. There's lots of great benefits of that, and I'll talk about that later. But that, again, when someone talks about problem-based learning, that's almost always involved. It's almost never one student tries to figure out a problem on their own. They're always working within a group. And then last, teacher as facilitator. And I like this little thing. You're not the sage on the stage. You're the guide on the side. And it's a fun little rhyming. But it really says, it's getting the teacher out of that model of saying, okay, you all need to be looking at me. I'm the expert telling you what you need to know, and it's gospel truth, so you should just listen to me because I'm the one who's standing up here. It's getting students to take some sort of ownership of their own education, to say, okay, I'm here to help you, and I know more than you probably about this, but my goal isn't to make you little me's. My goal is to help you work through these things and give you guidance when you need it. If they don't need it, hey, great. If they're figuring things out on their own, amazing. But you're there to kind of help keep them going in a better direction than if they start veering way off. So those are kind of the broad things. In terms of more specifics, there is a general process to problem-based learning. Now, first, students are given a problem. Now, this seems like a very quick one-sentence statement, but that problem has to be developed by you. You need to go through and figure out what is an issue and what's a problem that actually is going to get students interested and actually engaging this particular topic that you want to talk about. Now, problem building is sort of an art, sort of a science unto itself. You have to make it specific enough that you're addressing the issue you want to address, but not so specific that students are feeling like, okay, it's just connecting the dots. I have to go 1, 2, 3. There's no room for me to think differently than what this says. I have to work through it. So it's a little bit, you want it to be broad, but not too broad. So once students have the problem, and sometimes it could be a narrative problem, say you're in this given situation and this occurs, what do you do? They're asked to answer 3 questions about the issue. 1, what do you know? Because a lot of times students know something, or at least they've heard something on particular topics, especially in science and religion. They may not know where they heard it from, or they're not sure how viable it is, but they've heard things, and they feel like they know something about it. So the first step is say, okay, pull together your current knowledge. You don't have to start from zero. What do you already know? And some of those things may not be true, but it's good to know what's my starting base. The second question is, what do I need to know? If you're going to actually sufficiently answer this question that you're given and this problem that you're presented with, what information do you need to know to actually be able to do that intelligently? And the last, how do I find that information? Where do I even start looking for the answers to these questions? So that's kind of the main gist of what the students are going to be working through. And they seem like simple questions, but they take a lot of time for students to have to suss through even just what do they know about a particular topic. So after the students have kind of, in the session of answering those questions, they're going to be working in groups. As I said before, it's cooperative. Now, they're working in groups inside and outside of class. And this is one of the things where problem-based learning deviates from other forms, where class time is set aside for group work, not just find time outside of the classroom to work with your group on an issue. That it says it's important that you are sussing through these things together, that we're going to dedicate class time to it. One of the times I've done it, I encourage students to bring their laptops to class with them so they can do research in the classroom, because so much stuff is online now, some good, some bad, but students have access, and a lot of universities now give students online access to their library and various article databases, and which is amazing and great, and allows students to basically have a portable library with them. And I want students to take advantage of that fact. After students have kind of worked through the problem they've been given, or a lot of times you'll give them just part of a problem to start with, they present their solutions to the problem, and then they get feedback, not only from the professor, but from the other groups, because they've all been working on the same issue to try to say, okay, we figured out that this way is the best way to solve it. And say, okay, well, this group found out a different way, and we think you should incorporate this into your solution. And it's the broader collaborative process as well. So it really gets them going, and it gives you the opportunity as the teacher to very distinctly say, okay, that's interesting, but that's wrong. I mean, it's not a free-for-all. I mean, you are there just to keep them on track and not make sure to say, oh, you know, that solution is interesting, but this part of it is, I'm not sure where you got this information from, but it's way off. And so you are there, too, to help give them good constructive feedback to say, it's, you know, this part of your solution is good, but retailer this one because this isn't going to work. And then after that, students either continue deeper with the problem or go to a new one. Now, it's important to note that problem-based learning is not a all-or-nothing pedagogy, that you can incorporate it into a traditional kind of lecture setting and have some problems scattered through or even in a seminar setting. But there are people who will do almost an entire curriculum with problems. That is how they will go through all their content with their students, is through these problems, is they'll go from one to the other. But it could be something that you work in at the end of, say, a lecture session say the next one, okay, we're going to be doing problem-based learning in this next class session to really go through some of the stuff you just learned. Problem-based learning, and this is my kind of pitch to you all, I think problem-based learning turns a typical lecture classroom into a lab. That students are actively trying to find out answers to questions by trial and error in their groups. Now, for me, I really love that fact, that it takes, in my mind, some of the best part of science and says, you know, when you are in the lab trying to work through this problem, that is where you make these breakthroughs. That is where you finally say, oh, now I get it. Now I finally figured this out. After the 90th try, I figured this out, and now it all makes sense to me. That it gives the students that opportunity to make that connection in their mind. Much like what Michael was saying, too. If you tell them what it is, they're going to forget it. But if they figure it out on their own, that sticks that much deeper in their mind. Now, problem-based learning is not a perfect pedagogy by any stretch. It has its pros and its cons. Its strengths, I think, are a few here. First is student engagement. Those of you who have been doing stuff in education, at least in the last few years, this has been the big thing. Student engagement. How do we get students engaged in the topic? And I think problem-based learning does an amazing job of that. That it gives students real ownership into what they're doing, that they actually have to be actively involved in their learning process. They can't just sit there and listen to a lecture and try to somehow absorb it that way. That they are hands-on with their own learning. And there's been a lot of studies that show the more student engagement, the better retention there is for a lot of this information. So I think that in terms of if you really want students to learn something, increasing student engagement when possible is key. I also think along those same lines, there's this empowerment issue. I work and have worked with a number of seminaries, and one of the things I've realized is that seminaries in particular, though this could be stretched to undergrads too, especially in the area of science and religion, say, oh, there's those experts out there, and they'll tell me what I should know. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a theologian. I just, you know, I have to pastor a church. So, you know, I'm not an expert, so I'll just wait till tell me what I should know about it. Problem-based learning kind of flips that and says, no, that's fine. You can go to experts, but you are the one ultimately responsible for dealing with this problem. You can't call the expert in every time there's an issue. You're going to need to be the one that looks at the thing and brings that to the people that you're working with. And so it encourages them to take ownership of these issues, even if they aren't particularly experts. We want to give them good research abilities to know what experts to go and look at and talk to, but saying that at the end of the day, it's them that is responsible. Second, cooperative learning, and I've mentioned this before. One of the reasons why I think this is a strength, and other people have mentioned as well, is that typically when you're out in the world, when you're making discoveries, when you're working in business, no matter what it is, you're generally not working just by yourself. You have to work with the team at some point. Now, some people hate this fact, but it's an important skill that students need to learn. How do I work effectively in a group, especially in a group of people that I may not totally agree with, and try to come to some conclusion and some beneficial way to move forward? And so I think that's one of those kind of soft skills that PBL really helps students learn. Is how do I effectively learn in a group and work with these group of people to achieve a common goal. Last, and this is, I think, one of the biggest things that I love about problem-based learning, is that really lets you sink into the messiness of issues. The more open nature of problem-based learning allows students to kind of look at different angles of a question, kind of go down different routes when they're dealing with an issue. I think especially in science and religion, you get this fact that there's no issue that's just, oh, it's just, if they just kind of understood the evolutionary biology, everyone would be convinced. No, there's other things involved with things. So it really allows students to kind of look at the more holistic view of a particular issue, more so than one particular viewpoint would. Now, as I said, PBL is not perfect, and there are a number of issues that come with it. First off are bad problems. A number of people I've talked to have said that in problem-based learning, a bad problem is worse than a bad lecture. Because if the problem is either too broad, too narrow, not defined well, you really may not have students reaching those educational goals that you're setting for them. So if you're just trying it out and say, oh, I'm going to throw a problem in there and hope for the best, it probably may not work. And that's worse for your students than if you had a boring lecture. So that's one of the caveats, that you can't just throw it in there and assume everything's going to be fine. You actually have to put some genuine thought into it, and that knowing that a bad problem can be worse than other things. There's also assessment concerns. And a lot of this comes with, if you're dealing with group work, how do you adequately assess students' work when they're working as a team? Along these lines, whenever you have group work, there's always the problem of free riders. That one student who really isn't pulling their weight and the rest of the group is dedicated and they really want to get it going, so they'll get it done, but Johnny didn't do his part. So there are issues of how do you make sure that you're fairly giving grades and fairly assessing that they've met their educational requirements. That isn't insurmountable to overcome, but it's just something you have to think differently about. How do you assess students in this particular model? Student resistance, which this was an interesting one, because maybe because I got so excited about it, I was like, oh, how could students hate this? It's, you know, so engaging. But students, like faculty, are used to a very particular way of education. So if you have a student who's spent all their life listening to lectures and taking tests, when they get into a classroom that's not a lecture, they get uncomfortable. When they actually have to be engaged in a class, when they're used to just being able to sitting there and kind of playing on their laptop and looking up every now and then, they aren't always as happy about that. So some of it is changing the culture of students to say, okay, this is how we're doing education in this particular setting. You have to be involved. There may be some students say, I hate group work. Well, in this one, you have to learn how to learn in a group setting. I've even had students, and I think when I taught one, I had a chance to teach one session of PBL with a group of students this past semester. And one of the comments I received from students was, or just one student, was that I just wanted you to tell me what I should know. And I said, okay, you know, I didn't take that too much offense because I know that's not the purpose of PBL, but there was a student and that's their thing. You are the expert, just tell me what I'm supposed to think. I don't want to have to put a lot of time into this. And getting students out of that mindset, say, no, you're now in charge of your own education. And then last, there's always this issue of losing control. Again, when you're not the sage on the stage and you have a bunch of different groups of students working simultaneously in a classroom, how do you keep them on track? How do you keep them from going off on a topic that has nothing to do with the problem you're working on and they're just chatting about what happened at the dining hall the other day or something like that? Keeping them on task is a key thing. And also, along these same lines, how do you keep them on the task of the issue you want to deal with? How do you keep them from going way out because they get interested in a particular part of this topic? Now, some of that is being engaged as a professor and going around and making sure that checking in with the groups regularly and say, okay, where are you at now? What are you working on? But it is a risk that it can get out of hand if you don't try to reel it in at times. Now, why PBL for religion and science courses? And so I have three main reasons why I think this is a great potential for religion and science courses. One, science and religion courses often deal with issues that are multifaceted and complex. As we have noticed from this meeting, a lot of these issues that we're dealing with are not simple answers, that there are multiple areas that things are coming from that isn't just, oh, well, they just don't understand the science. Well, maybe there's theological issues that are underpinning this, or political issues, or personal issues. That it's helping students to see that these aren't just these simple one-off answers to these problems, that you actually have to look at the bigger picture to get a fuller understanding of what's going on. And I think PBL, when you kind of give a little bit more of that openness, allows students to see that kind of more holistic view. The issues in science and religion are constantly changing. PBL helps promote adaptivity. We all know this. Science is not the same now as it was 10 years ago. But if a science religion course kind of teaches a scientific issue and says, okay, here it is. Here's all the genetics you need to know forever. It gives students that false sense of security that, oh, no, I get genetics. I understand it. But even though we all know it's going to be changing. And PBL, in my mind, makes students think about, okay, I need to keep researching this thing. That this article that I read from 20 years ago is different than the article I read from 10 years ago when I was looking at this topic. And keeping in mind saying, okay, you can't just say, oh, this little information I learned is going to cover everything. Give them that wider view of saying, you need to keep up with this. You need to keep being empowered in your own education to keep researching these issues. And last, it allows students to really delve into the so what questions involved in the issues. I've given a couple different talks, and this is essentially what I said when I was at the AAAS ATS thing. They asked me to comment on science in seminary education. And what I said was, one of the reasons why it's not there is that I think students have a hard time answering this question, so what? Why should I care about genetics? Why should I care about evolution? I'm going to be a pastor. I have to deal with picking hymns and giving sermons and things like that. Why should I even care about science? No one's made me do it up to this point. Why should I care now? I think when PBL is done well, it gives students that bigger view so they can actually see, how does this actually apply to my life, whether as an undergrad or a seminary student or wherever it happens to be. It opens it up in a way that they don't have to be constricted to say, oh, that's just, the philosophers can worry about that. That's not me. To say, no, it actually does affect you, and here's how. So those are kind of the three things that I think are particularly the biggest reasons why it might be worth considering to use PBL in a science religion course. Now, one example, and I've mentioned before, is seeing how would PBL work with something like this. And so I thought about the idea of genetics. So now genetics, if you're going to present an issue, and you're going to have students look at it, of course, what do you want them to look at first, possibly? Well, you're going to look at the science. Say, okay, what's the current scientific state of genetics? And you're going to have to try to figure out a way to do it in such a sense that most of them may not be geneticists. So how do you point them towards particular resources? Say, okay, you may want to research here and look there to kind of get some good information. But with genetics, we know this is a big issue. So you also have to think about theology when we think about genetics. One of my professors in seminary, Ted Peters, talks about genetics and says, does your genetic code define who you are? Is that the source of your personhood? And again, if I'm genetically inclined to do this, does that mean I'm determined to end up this way? All these great theological and faith questions that come up with genetics. But it doesn't stop there. There's the ethical ramification of it. When we're thinking about the future of genetic research and how it's applied, what are students going to think when they say, okay, well, we can start doing genetic screenings for infants still in the womb? Are there ethical ramifications for that? What are they? What are we going to do? There's also politics. I don't have to go too much into that. Say, there are great political debates about what is the status of using genetics. How much is it invasion of privacy with genetic information going out there in the world? And along that line, there's economics. There's a lot of money in genetics, and there's probably going to be even more in the future. And so this is just kind of one example of saying, okay, here's this little problem you could start with. You could just start with something like, my Aunt Nellie went to the doctor and they said, we want to do a genetic screening for this condition. Start there. And then you can see how broad it can go out to say, okay, what should you tell Aunt Nellie to do? Should she go get this genetic screening? What about when she gets the answers? How should she try to figure it out? So-and-so is lurking on this law that's going to affect her. What do you think should you write to that congressperson? There's great ways that you can put real problems in front of them on particular issues like this. Now, there's a great resource if you're looking for something and you want to learn more, and it's three professors all out of the University of Rhode Island coming from three different disciplines. One's a sociologist, one's a soil scientist, one's an English literature professor, all looking at how they're using problem-based learning in their classrooms. There's some great examples of problems they've done. They've put a ton of work into it, and they've spent a few years trying to refine what it means to do good problems. So if you are interested, I highly recommend it. It's a little book. It's not that expensive. But if you're interested, it's a great resource. So it's The Practice of Problem-Based Learning, A Guide to Implementing PBL in the College Classroom. In terms of my own future research with this, really there's one key thing. I need help. I am a mere graduate student still working in coursework, which means very few people are trusting me with a classroom at this point. So what I need is I need people willing to try this for me, to try out a problem and say, hey, this worked great, or hey, this worked terribly. I want to know that. But I need people who are willing to at least try it. Now, again, it's not, I'm not saying devote a whole semester to it. But think about taking a couple class sessions and having students do this instead of a typical lecture and see how it works. If you're willing to do that, please get in touch with me. I would love to know what happens. I'd love to work with you. Along those same lines is the development of new and better problems. As I said before, the strength of PBL really lies on the strength of the problem. Bad problems are going to just make bad results. So I need help from folks who have more expertise in certain areas than I do to really help develop some of these problems and figure out what would be a good question to ask students. A number of you have been teaching much longer than I have. What issues and concerns really get them going? And working on problems that kind of play to those strengths and get students engaged right from the get-go. That's it. Thank you. Yes. I taught a session of a course. It was a science and religion course. It was at Claremont McKenna College, which is a small private liberal arts school. The students were mixed. There were some Christians, some not, some very, they're eager to say that they're atheists, so it was a very mixed group. And it worked well to some extent. What didn't work well was trying to have them do it in one class session, to not have any sort of build up to it, to get them thinking about it. And like I said before, there was the student resistance of, oh, we've been in a lecture all semester, now you're throwing this at us. So that was the one thing that definitely was an issue. It was, most of the responses were very positive, and when I was walking around the classroom, students were staying on task, and they really enjoyed working through the problem that I had. But it was a one-hour class, and I was trying to shove a lot into it. So it was kind of a good feeler, but again, it wasn't a great way to say, okay, this clearly worked or it didn't work. It showed me, say, okay, you know, I needed to, the problem I was working on, I needed to refine it a little bit better to keep it more on track. But it was interesting to see the way the students went. One group really went on the issue. They were interested in who was lobbying for this particular issue in Congress, because they were government-y type students, and that's what really excited them. And so they brought that to the group element, say, oh, hey, we found this out. And so I think it worked okay, but again, for the capacity it was, it could have been a lot better if I had more time to actually work with the students and kind of go from there. The problem was actually I told them that they were on a plane and that they were sitting next to someone on their way to an ID conference and that said, oh, hey, you're taking a science religion class. What do you think about intelligent design? And a lot of the students didn't really know much about intelligent design. So this was their introduction to, okay, I want you to go on and see what are people saying about it. What are the various groups that are kind of promoting it, various groups that are fighting it? And so they were learning themselves, say, okay, what is this controversy all about based on being able to just kind of doing some of its cursory. When you Google intelligent design, what comes up? What are people seeing the most of? And trying to delve in and look. And one of the nice things about it was kind of the unexpected benefit of PBL is that I was teaching some research skills to some of these students. Because one pull up an article and say, hey, I got this great article about intelligent design and its scientific merits. I said, okay, who wrote it? This guy. I was like, okay, where are they from? Well, they're a lawyer. I'm like, okay, so if you're looking at a scientific issue, do you want the paper by a lawyer to be the focus of if it's valid or not? And so it was a great opportunity to say, okay, it's important to check your sources. You can't just say, oh, I found a paper. This counts. Like, well, no. Sometimes you need to make sure you're getting a good paper that you're that you're citing. So.
One of the constraints with problem-based learning, certainly in Canada, is that all our colleges and universities articulate, so we have a very set curriculum.
Okay.
And as the questions fit the curriculum.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, that's one of the things where it really does depend. I mean, if you are more constrained with, you have to teach this particular way, I mean, that's... You have to teach what you have to teach, unfortunately. But if you can try to find creative ways of saying, I need to make sure I teach this content, you might be able to make a problem fit to make sure the students cover that same content. So if they need to meet certain standards, either for the university or a national standard or a professional standard, there are ways of of making the problems fit so that students are still getting that same information. But again, it takes a little bit of creativity to make sure that they're addressing those exact things. Yes.
I've experienced both sides of being in a problem-based learning situation where the group winds up being kind of duddish. You know, and it's, you know, what does the teacher do to rescue a bad mix of students?
Yeah. One of the things that I unfortunately failed to mention that a number of researchers have said that, again, is a drawback of problem-based learning is if students have no real experience in problem-solving, they're not going to do well. If they have no framework of, say, how do I even go about solving a problem, they're going to fail. And so sometimes it may be starting a course with basic critical thinking skills, saying, okay, when you're given this issue, how do you go about solving a problem? How do you say, okay, I'm going to methodically kind of break it up and say, I want to find this, 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 and this, and setting that framework for them. But if they just really aren't getting it, again, it's having that, some of it's experience to kind of go and say, okay, how do I start pushing them in the right direction? So if they're really getting stuck here, I mean, it's appropriate to say, okay, y'all are getting stuck in this particular situation. Here's a little bit of information to keep you going. I mean, there definitely can be punctuated times to say, okay, I'm going to give you a quick 5-minute spiel about this topic to kind of get you guys moving again. And being aware that it's not just knowing that you're right, then there are going to be times when students are just not going to be able to figure it out. And helping them as, again, still in that kind of as a guide facilitator role as opposed to, okay, didn't figure it out, now I'm going to go talk to you for 40 minutes about what you should be thinking. So it's trying to find that balance of pushing them on but not all of a sudden being like, okay, no, I'm going to take this back now because you're not getting it.
All right. Thanks, Blake, for an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
Welcome to come up on the stage. It's not that intimidating.